Good morning, everyone. My name is Erman Eyday from EPFL, and this is a joint work from my colleagues from Computer and Communication Science Department and from the School of Life Sciences at EPFL. And the talk is about privacy-preserving computation of disease risk by using genomic and non-genomic data. So let me start with some facts on genomics. By the way, the talk will be mostly dominated by genomic stuff, because non-genomic thing is already known by many of you. So let me start with a few facts about genomics. As you know, genomic data provides a lot of opportunities for diagnosis and preventive medicine, and there are several recent research papers appearing in Science and Nature almost every week. And the main cause of this is the decreasing cost of whole genome sequencing. It was much expensive 10 years ago, as you can see from this graph. And right now, a complete genome profile is just below $100 for genome-wide genotyping, which provides you all the genomic letters in order to test your disease status for particular genomic diseases. And it's not all only investment. Genomic research also created a lot of opportunities, and this is a recent article from Bloomberg, and you can see that the investment in the last decade is about $15 billion, and the outcome of this investment in terms of jobs, drugs, expanding genetics is more than $900 billion, so it's a huge industry. Most of you may be familiar with some of the online services that provides that takes your genomic data and provides various services to you. One of them is Ancestry.com, that you can upload your genomic data and try to find your ancestors just based on your genomic data. Another one is Consul.com, in which you can figure out if your potential offspring will have a particular disease or not based on the parent and based on the parent's genomic data. More interesting maybe more important services, for example, 23andMe, doing some genetic disease risk tests based on your genomic data. And here's a screenshot from the 23andMe. You can see that for one dummy profile for different diseases that have genomic criteria, you can see your risk with respect to the average risk of a particular population. And one of the most recent examples of this type of test is the Angelina Jolie case. I'm sure most of you are aware of this, in which she had to do double mastectomy because she figured out that she was carrying two risky genes for breast cancer. So let me tell you a few words about why do we care protecting genomic data. It's just letters at the end. But first of all, genomic data carries a lot of information about your genetic conditions and predisposition to specific diseases. And this fact may cause a lot of abuses, threats, and genetic discrimination. And here is a movie, actually, from a very old movie from 1997, and I strongly recommend you to watch it if you haven't done so, which actually clearly tells you what genetic discrimination is. Another thing is genome carries a lot of information, not just of you, but of your family as well. And if the genomic data is revealed, it's non-revocable. That's another bad thing. And here is a recent case about the family relationship as well. So this lady, Henrietta Lacks, deceased in 1951. And her genome is recently sequenced by the researchers and uploaded to a public genome sharing website. And there has been a huge controversy between her family members and the researchers, because the family members were claiming that the genome includes information about them as well, which they were right. And actually, we have a very interesting paper coming in this year's CCS about this case, which I'll be happy to talk later. And one final thing, you can assume that I have my genomic data. I can just remove my name and publish it online. Nobody would know that it's my genomic data. But the thing is, genomic data is a unique identifier. It's like a social security number. So once it's revealed, it is also possible to identify the owner just looking at the letters of your DNA. And here is another recent work a few months ago published in Science, showing how the contributors to 1,000 Genome Project are identified with their names and last names. Originally, they were anonymized by the system. And actually, we have an interesting survey about the chills and thrills of whole genome sequencing. Recent survey, you can just get it from this link, or again, I'll be happy to provide it to you. And tomorrow, I'm happy to invite you to the talk of Jean-Pierre Hubo at HATSEC. I know it's a different workshop, but just bear with me for a second, on privacy considerations of genome sequencing. So having said that, it's not always genomic data. The research shows that the non-genomic attributes of the individuals also contribute to the disease risk significantly. And these non-genomic attributes we call clinical and environmental data. And what's this clinical and environmental data? It can be your demographic information, your family history, the list of diseases that you have, or result of your laboratory tests. And the important thing is this data, these non-genomic attributes, can be also very privacy sensitive, like HIV status or like the diseases of your family members for which they are not willing to reveal. Therefore, such data should be also considered private and also should be integrated in the disease risk test because it also significantly contributes to those tests. So here's our motivation, so why we do this work. So, okay, you are having a disease risk test. You want to learn your susceptibility for a particular disease as a probabilistically, but you may not want to reveal all your attributes that are associated with this particular disease, genomic and non-genomic attributes. And what's important is for most medical units, the important thing is the end result of the test. So you don't really need to provide all these individual attributes to those medical units, which are privacy-sensitive attributes. And all these genomic and non-genomic data plays very important role in disease risk tests. So one may be shy to reveal his HIV status, for example, even to his doctor. But the absence of that information creates a lot of difference in the test. So it has a very significant contribution. So all the data should be provided correctly and accurately. And the medical unit should only see the end result of the test without obtaining the individual attributes of the people. So here is briefly our contribution. So we propose a system for protecting the privacy of individuals' sensitive genomic and non-genomic data while enabling the medical units to process such data to perform disease risk tests. And we use two cryptographic tools, homomorphic encryption and privacy-preserving integer comparison, in order to achieve our goals. And finally, we implement and show the practicality of our work at the end of my presentation. So before diving into the presentation, let me show you a few potential applications of this type of work. So this is not just crypto, after all. So a pharmacist, for example, checking if a given drug can be harmful to a patient, for example, an over-the-counter drug, or a pharmaceutical company trying to detect the case and control group for a pharmaceutical study. Another potential application is a regional health ministry trying to optimize the population-wide preventive medicine effort, or online direct-to-consumer service provider offering individual disease risk tests for early diagnosis, for example. And as you can see, in all these cases, patients or individuals really don't need to provide their individual privacy-sensitive attributes to those services. The only important thing is the end result of the test. So that's what we are trying to achieve, actually. So just a few words about the genomics, in case you don't have too much background. The human genome consists approximately about 3 billion letters, and it is known that almost 99.9% of this genome, these 3 billion letters, is identical between any two individuals. And the remaining part is called the human genetic variation. So the most common human genetic variation is single nucleotide polymorphism, and shortly it's called SNP. And single nucleotide polymorphism is the case of a single letter differing between the members of the same species. I'll show you a single example here. So this is a partial DNA profile from one individual, and this is a partial DNA profile from a second individual. And let's look at this particular address. And on the DNA, each letter has a particular address, actually. Let's look at this particular address, and let's look at the upper letters, actually. The lower letters, this G and this A, just complementary nucleotides. So let's look at this C and T. As you can see, at this position, this individual has C and this individual has T. So this is a variation. This is a changing variation between two members of a given species. And these nucleotides at this SNP position are called the alleles, actually. And typically, there are two different alleles observed for each SNP position. And in this example, it's either C or T. And everyone carries two alleles at each SNP position. Each individual inherits one allele from his mother and another allele from his father, which will be more clear in the next slide. So it's shown by many recent researchers that the disease risk can be computed by analyzing the particular SNPs of the patients of the individuals. Typically, one of these alleles carries the risk for the corresponding disease, and the other allele just does not contribute. So let's again return back to this example and assume that this particular SNP is associated with some disease X. And as I said before, there are two alleles here, which one is C and the other is T. If we assume that the risk allele is C, the genotypes for this particular, for one particular individual can be CC, TT, or CT. As I said, one allele is inherited from the mother and the other is inherited from the father. And because of this, we represent each SNP as three values, 0, 1, or 2, based on the number of risk alleles it carries. In this particular example, CC is 2 because we have two risk alleles, TT is 0, and CT is 1 because we have only one risk allele. So how do we compute the disease risk by using all these SNPs? So these SNPs are associated with different diseases, and the association between the SNP and a particular disease is usually expressed as the odds ratio. And I'll just give you an example about how this odds ratio is computed. For example, odds ratio of a variation Y for disease X. And you can assume this variation Y as either a genomic factor or non-genomic factor. It can be either the case that the patient is carrying two risk alleles, or it can be the fact that the patient is smoking. So it can be anything. So let's look at this example. Let's assume we have two sets of individuals. In one set, we have 10 individuals with some disease X. And in the second set, we have 10 individuals without disease X. And in the first set, we have two individuals with without variation Y and 8 individuals with the variation Y. And in the second set, similarly, we have 8 individuals without this time variation Y and 2 individuals with the variation Y. So we can compute the odds. This is not the odds ratio yet. We can compute the odds of disease X for the individuals having the variation as the ratio of this to this, which is 4. And similarly, odds of disease X for the individuals not having the variation as a ratio of this to this, 1 divided by 4. And the final odds ratio for the variation Y for disease X is the ratio of this to this, which is 16. And you can think of this as, so the people with variation Y has 16 times more risk to have disease X as opposed to people without variation Y. And this is usually represented as the regression coefficient, which is just the logarithm of this value. And this, in this example, is 2.77. So how do we use these odds ratios and the SNPs to compute the to compute the disease risk, actually? Let me start by showing you how to compute the genetic risk. Then I'll show you how to combine the genetic risk with the non-genomic attributes to compute the final disease risk. So first of all, we use a logistic regression model in order to compute this disease risk, and it's like a weighted average, actually. So we call S, capital S, as the genetic risk of a patient, and it is computed, alpha is just a parameter, it's just a model parameter. And it's just a weighted sum, as you can see, of the SNPs that are associated with a particular disease. So beta is the, as I said, the regression coefficients of the particular SNPs that are associated with this disease. And this PIJ is just a variable showing the states of these SNPs. As I said, each SNP can be either 0, 1, or 2. If it's 0, PI takes a value. If it's 1, it takes another value. If it's 2, it takes another value. And once we compute this genetic disease risk, it has to be also categorized to its risk group. So usually we have a distribution of the risk. And in this example, we have 4 quantiles, for example, 1, 2, 3, 4. And all these classes are called quantiles. I'm sorry, I didn't mention that. All these classes are called quantiles. And once we compute this genetic disease risk, we have to map it to one of these quantiles based on its value. So we just compare it with the boundaries of this distribution. If it's mapped to this quantile, and based on the mapping, actually, we compute the genetic regression coefficient of one individual for this particular disease. For example, if it's mapped to this third quantile, then the genetic regression coefficient becomes B3, beta 3. So once we also compute it, then finally we integrate it with the non-genomic attributes of the patients. And again, we use a logistic regression model for this. And here is the final formula. It's again a weighted average actually. Beta zero is just the system parameter. Beta G is the genetic regression coefficient that we obtained as a result of the mapping on this distribution. And this last term represents the non-genomic attributes. Each Ni is representing a non-genomic attribute of the patient, which I'll show more later. And each beta bar I represents the regression coefficient for the non-genomic attribute, which is also computed as in the previous example I showed you. So this is our system model. I'll just briefly introduce you the parties here. So we have a patient, we have a certified institution, which does the sequencing actually. Patient provides his DNA sample, like a blood or saliva, and certified institution does the sequencing and the encryption. After the sequencing, the encrypted SNPs are encrypted at the certified institution and stored at a storage and processing unit, which we call SPU in short. And the non-genomic attributes of the patient are either encrypted at the patient site and sent to the SPU, or they are encrypted by the medical unit and sent to the SPU based on how they are obtained. For example, a patient can just enter his weight or height by himself, but some tests of some medical results like the sugar blood level or cholesterol level can be provided by his medical unit to the SPU. And the disease risk test is done between the storage and processing unit, between the SPU and the medical unit MU, by using a secure two-party computation method, which I'll show in a few slides. So here are a few assumptions that we have. So the important thing is we assume that the certified institution is a trusted entity, which is unfortunately indispensable for the sequencing with today's technology, because you provide your blood or saliva to this unit, and that unit has to see the output of the sequencing machine. So we assume that that unit is trustworthy. Also, we assume that the patient's data is stored using pseudonym, so we don't store the identities of the patients at the SPU. And we use PAIA crypto system for the encryption of the data, which supports homomorphic addition, multiplication of the ciphertext with a constant, and also proxy re-encryption, which is also like a secret sharing of a private key between two or more parties. Here we assume just two parties. And here is our threat model. Briefly, we assume the existence of a passive attacker at the medical unit and a curious party at the SPU. And the goal of these two attackers is to obtain privacy-sensitive attributes of the patient for which they are not authorized for. We assume that both the MU and the SPU follows the protocols properly, so it's honest but curious attack model. There is no, we assume no collusion between the part between these two parties, MU and the SPU. And we also finally assume that the access control to medical, access control to genomic and non-genomic data is regulated by the SPU. Because, you know, I mean, the MU will want to do some particular test to a particular patient, and the access control of the MU to see whether he is authorized to do such tests are regulated by the SPU. So a few words about how we encrypt the data. As I said, the CI, the certified institution, encrypts the genomic data of the patient. And we assume that it encrypts the contents of the SNPs, SNP positions of a patient, the SNP I introduced a few slides ago. Okay. And whenever I use the bracket here, it means that the content is encrypted by using PAIA crypto system. Not only the contents of the SNPs are encrypted, but we also assume that the squared values of those SNPs are also encrypted. It's not a requirement, it's just for simplicity. It can, once the contents of the SNPs are encrypted, the squared values can be obtained actually by using a secure two-party computation between the MU and the SPU, but here we assume that they are also encrypted. And the MU or the patient encrypts the non-genomic data separately, for example, smoking, hypertension. Here, for the simplicity, I showed that the non-genomic data is binary, but it can be, as you know, I mean, totally unbinary. The cholesterol level of the patient can be any number, any integer. But depending on the type of the test, it can be easily converted to a binary number. It can be easily classified by using our privacy-preserving protocol. So a few words about the test, how we do the test by using the encrypted SNPs. So the MU requests some genomic and non-genomic data of the patient from the SPU for a particular test. And the SPU verifies that MU has the required access rights. As I said, the SPU does the access control. And then MU first computes the genetic risk of the patient for the particular disease. So this is exactly the same formula I showed you a few slides ago. This is just how it's done on encrypted SNPs. Again, we have the betas as the regression coefficient. We have the SNPs because, I mean, the reason we have a longer formula here, I just wanted to show how this is done in encrypted form. And these are just indicators to figure out whether the SNPs content is either 0, 1, or 2. So once we find the genetic risk test encrypted, then we need to map this to the distribution graph. If you remember this graph, we need to map it to one of the quantiles in this graph. So we need to compare it with the boundaries of this distribution, actually. So the goal is neither the MU nor the SPU should learn the value of the computed genetic risk during this computation. So the idea is MU computes a value, a L bit number Z, which is 2 times L plus S minus the boundary value. And let's assume that ZL minus 1 represents the most significant bit of Z. So if ZL minus 1 is equal to 0, then S is less than B, boundary. And if ZL minus 1 is equal to 1, then S is greater or bigger than the boundary. So that's great. We just need to find ZL minus 1. And this is how it can be computed. ZL minus 1 is just Z minus Z mod 2 to the power of L. But the problem is this operation is not supported on an encrypted domain. So in order to compute this, we need to do secure two-party computation between the SPU and the MU, which I'm not going to go into the details, and I'll be happy to discuss offline later. And it's an efficient protocol. I'll show you the numbers at the end of my presentation. So let's assume that we computed ZL minus 1, which is G. So this is the comparison of the result of the computed genetic test with one of the boundaries. If G is equal to 0, then S is less than the boundary. If G is equal to 1, S is greater than or equal to boundary. So MU computes the genetic regression coefficient, beta G, by combining all the results of the of these comparisons. So if we have n quantiles in this distribution graph, we only need n minus 1 comparisons between the MU and the SPU. So once we combine those, we obtain the genetic regression coefficient. And finally, by combining the genetic regression coefficient with the non-genomic attributes of the patient, we obtain the final regression coefficient, and from that we obtain the probability that the patient will have a disease, particular disease. Sorry, okay. So we implemented this by using real data, or using the genomic profile of a patient from 1,000 Genome Project, and computed the coronary artery disease risk by using real data from a recent study of our colleagues. And we found out that there are 23 SNPs associated with this particular disease, 14 non-genomic factors, 4 genetic risk groups, quantiles, and the odds ratio is computed with over 2,000 individuals. And these are our parameters, system parameters. Important thing is the size of the security parameter is 4K. And this is the data we used. These are all the SNPs. These are the positions of those SNPs. As I said, a SNP has 2 alleles. These are the alleles of those SNPs. This is the risk allele, for example, for the first SNP, and the odds ratio, the contributions of the SNPs to the disease. And these are the odds ratios for the non-genomic factors here, as you can see. So we use such data. And this is just a screenshot from our demo. So here we have the patient GUI. We have the medical unit GUI. The patient can encrypt his non-genomic factors and send a request to the medical unit for a particular test, and the medical unit, with the help of the SPU, with this two-party secure computation, it can compute the CAD risk of a patient eventually, and it only obtains this end result, nothing else, during the test. And one last slide, just showing the numbers from our implementation. And the important thing I'll show you here, so for this particular test, for example, it takes about 6 minutes to compute this test, to do everything, actually. And the result that it's too high, it's the first of all, the code is not optimized. It's just a proof of concept. And the security parameter in the PAIA crypto system, we took 4K, which is a substantially large value. So in conclusion, we proposed a framework to securely store the genomic and non-genomic data of individuals while providing disease risk tests by the medical units. The system provides the privacy of the patients against the curious party at the SPU and the medical and an attacker at the medical unit. We showed the efficiency of the system, and we believe that this type of system would encourage the use of genomic and non-genomic data by ensuring the patients that their privacy is preserved during such tests. And thank you. That's it. For more questions, you can email or refer to our webpage.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to tell everyone that if you have a question, and we have a couple minutes for questions, that you use the microphone. Otherwise, the speaker should repeat it because the session's being recorded.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Question.
Yeah.
Marcel Simo from J&J. How does the scale?
Marcel Simo from J&J. How does the system scale? Could this potentially scale to databases that have millions of patient data in them?
Yeah, as I showed here, so currently the storage overhead is about 50 gigabytes per patient, but this can be totally optimized. Actually, we are also trying to optimize it right now. It can be totally reduced to like tenfold, about to 5 gigabytes. Mm-hmm. And we believe that it's a reasonable storage capacity for one patient, even if you have 1 million patients. It is still, in terms of storage overhead, it's still reasonable. For the computation, if you have parallel requests for different patients, we are also analyzing it right now, actually, to see how many medical units can do parallel requests for different patients from a single storage unit.
Thanks.
Sure.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.